We'll stay in the past with a look at Civil War coverage, with a focus on the double-edged sword of embedding journalists with military units on the ground. 150 years ago, two journalists headed with Union troops to chronicle the attack on the Confederate stronghold of Vicksburg, Mississippi. It turned out to be just the beginning of a long and perilous odyssey. Junius Brown and Albert Richardson, correspondents for Horace Greeley's feisty New York Tribune, didn't practice journalism quite as it's done today, but they did risk life, limb, and liberty in the Deep South to dispatch news of the Civil War to the North. Peter Carlson, author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, says the reporters were odd bedfellows, but a formidable team.
Albert Richardson was a strong, stocky guy from a farm in Massachusetts. He could go anywhere, talk to all the important people, and get the story. Junius was the scrawny, prematurely bald kid with jug ears who had grown up in a rich family in Cincinnati. He read philosophy for fun. He was not a particularly good reporter. He was too shy. His modus operandi was to stand in the background and then write an ironic piece with a lot of literary references.
Well, let's listen to an example of Junius Brown's purple prose, one of his dispatches from the Battle of Fort Donelson, the Union's first big victory in the war.
Ever and anon, a loud cheer went up for the Union, and this was caught up at a distance and echoed by our soldiers and re-echoed by the surrounding hills. Many a brave warrior heard that glorious shout as his senses reeled in death and his spirit went forth embalmed with the assurance that he had not fallen in vain.
Now, there's a footnote, Peter, to this story. Junius, the scrawny little aesthete, apparently played a part in the victory.
Yes, Junius was with a group of snipers at the Battle of Fort Donelson, and they were trying to pick off the guys in a Confederate artillery battery. And the Union snipers kept failing to shoot them. So one of the snipers handed Junius a rifle and said, "Can you shoot?" So Junius aims, and when the Confederate pops up, he fires the rifle. And bingo, the Confederate battery stops firing. So the sniper says, "I think you fixed him that time." "I wouldn't be surprised," Brown replied, although, of course, he was completely surprised. He didn't know how to shoot.
I'm just trying to imagine a contemporary reporter using a weapon while embedded with troops.
There were no journalistic ethics in those days.
Later, Brown filed a story invented out of whole cloth, or at least stitched from little patches.
Yes, he did. Junius and a reporter from The World, Richard Colburn, were in St. Louis when they learned that the Union Army in Missouri had headed south to invade Arkansas. They were about 200 miles away when they began to get little telegraphed reports that there had been a battle, the Battle of Pea Ridge in Arkansas, and that it was very bloody and that the Union had won. They also knew that Thomas Knox of the rival New York Herald was actually at the battle and would no doubt be scooping them. So from their hotel room in Rolla, 200 miles away, Junius wrote a long purple story about the battle as if he had seen it too.
Bayonet, musket, sword, and cannon all did their bloody work, and the earth was stained and slippery with human gore. Every loyal soldier kept his eye fixed on his fearless leader. Wherever they saw his streaming hair and flashing sword, they knew all was safe.
And, of course, they were discovered and fired.
No, they were discovered, and everyone in the business was highly amused. Before they were discovered, Horace Greeley wrote an editorial saying how great the story was and that it should be reproduced and given to all Union soldiers. And later, the Times of London reported that it was the best story of the war. The press in those days made no bones about objectivity. Greeley was a mover and shaker in the Republican Party, and he had been a backer of Lincoln. He helped Lincoln get the nomination for president in 1860.
Well, this kind of advocacy would figure into the travails of Richardson and Brown. So let's get to the heart of their adventure. It began as they were embedded with Union troops on a barge on the Mississippi.
General Grant was going to attack Vicksburg, and if the Union took Vicksburg, they would cut the Confederacy in half. So Richardson and Brown were eager to get to Grant's army. So they got on this barge, which was bringing hay to Grant's horses, and they had to sail past Vicksburg. And the rebels just fired all their cannons from Vicksburg, blew it up, and Junius and Albert and those Union soldiers who were still alive jumped into the water and floated on hay bales heading south. The Confederates sent out a boat and captured Junius and Albert and their friend Colburn from the New York World.
Now, as noncombatants, they expected to be quickly released. And the Confederate bureaucracy actually gave them parole papers, which entitled them to be exchanged quickly for noncombatants being held by the Union troops. Didn't work out that way.
No, it didn't. When they got to Richmond, they were put in Libby prison. And then all of the soldiers who were captured with them and Colburn were paroled, but Junius and Albert were not. When the Union bureaucracy wrote to the Confederates in charge of prisoner exchange, Robert Ould, the Confederate agent of exchange, wrote back and basically said, "We hate the Tribune and we're not releasing these guys."
It seems to me that if any exceptions be made as to noncombatants, it should be against such men as the Tribune correspondents, who have had more share even than your soldiery in bringing rapine, pillage, and desolation to our homes. You ask why I will not release them? 'Tis because they are the worst and most obnoxious of all noncombatants.
For the next 20 months, the Union kept trying to trade Confederate reporters for Brown and Richardson, and Ould kept refusing.
You discovered in the letters that they were writing back north a great deal of celebration about General Grant's victory at Vicksburg. That struck you as odd because...
because they didn't mention the victory of the Union at Gettysburg, which had taken place a day earlier and hundreds of miles closer. You would think they would have been celebrating that one, too.
But why weren't they?
Well, they were reading the Richmond newspapers, and the Richmond newspapers were informing their readers that the Confederates had won a great victory at Gettysburg.
Our army victorious at Gettysburg. The Yankee army retreating. The whole breed are as nervously fearful of gunpowder and bloodshed as women and Negroes.
They even ran Union newspaper accounts of the victory at Gettysburg, and then they would announce at the bottom that everyone knows this is a pack of Yankee lies.
Junius and Albert were in one prison and then transferred to another, and then finally they were moved to a prison called Salisbury.
And when Junius and Albert got there in February of 1864, they were thrilled because they had been kept in these stiflingly hot tobacco warehouses in Richmond. Now they were in Salisbury, which had a beautifully grassed yard with stately trees. In fact, they played baseball on good days. At that point, there were only a few hundred prisoners there.
In the beginning, it was kind of like the scene in Goodfellas, where Paulie and the gang were in prison making gourmet dinners and smoking cigars. What happened?
In the fall of 1864, the Confederates were besieged in Richmond, and they sent most of the prisoners there south, some of them to the now infamous Andersonville in Georgia, and others to Salisbury. So instead of having a few hundred prisoners, all of them housed indoors, you now had over 9,000 prisoners living in holes in the ground or crude makeshift tents. And it rained and it snowed and guys were starving. The Union Army had deliberately destroyed the breadbaskets of Virginia, so there was no food to feed the prisoners.
Junius Brown wrote about that in one of his letters to his managing editor, Sidney Gay.
About 1,000 have died, and mortality is on the increase. At the present rate of death, next August will find none of us alive. But then we will be free. Dante, with all his gloom and horror of his inferno, did not dream of that.
Junius and Albert volunteered to help in the so-called hospitals, which were basically just spaces indoors where very sick men would lie on the floor with some hay around them. Albert was made the clerk of the hospital, so he kept records of all the sick men and whether they died or not. Junius went out into the yard with the few medicines that they had, and would crawl into the holes they were living in and give them some medicine and try to cheer them up. At one point, someone asked him what kind of physician he was, and he said he was an amateur physician. Many of the soldiers had no idea what that meant and thought that was some kind of higher degree of doctor because he seemed to be better than the ones inside.
At this stage, your book pivots. The privileges conferred upon them as volunteers in the hospital enabled them to just stroll outside of the prison and commence a 300-mile odyssey to freedom.
Yes, they knew that the closest Union army was in Knoxville, Tennessee. And they escaped on December 18th. It was very cold, and they had to cross the Blue Ridge and then the Appalachians. In the flatlands near Salisbury, they knew that they could ask the slaves to hide and feed them. In the mountains, though, there were very few slaves. It was mostly small farms. So they had to rely on a secret organization called the Heroes of America, a pro-Union secret organization with secret signals and handshakes. Those people would lead them from one safe place to another.
So over the course of about a month, they traversed snowy mountain ranges and at last found their way to Knoxville and the U.S. Army.
Albert's cold, he's wet, he's half-starved, but he has the presence of mind to send back a telegram. All it said was, Knoxville, Tennessee.
Knoxville, Tennessee. January 13th, 1865. Out of the jaws of death, out of the mouth of hell. Albert D. Richardson.
And it's a quote from a very famous and very popular Tennyson poem. So Greeley receives this, publicizes it, and they return to New York and write up the stories of their adventures.
Books that they turned around rather quickly, both bestsellers. These guys were sort of the Woodward and Bernstein of their day, only probably with better calf muscles.
Yes, they were. Richardson sold about 90,000 copies. Brown's maybe 70,000. That is a great sale even today.
Peter, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Peter Carlson is author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, A Civil War Odyssey. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson. We had more help from Ravenna Koenig and Alexandra Hall. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. And our boss, bassist composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.